Hi, this is Steve Roost, and you're listening to Health Tech Hour on UK Health Radio. Each week, we give you the best news, views, and interviews from the health technology world. From CEOs and founders to entrepreneurs and clinicians, the companies and people that are shaping the future face of healthcare. All on the world's number one talk health radio. Hello and welcome to this week's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roost. Each week we bring you the best news, views and interviews from the founders, CEOs, clinicians, politicians, journalists that are changing the face of the healthcare industry in the UK and beyond. As regular listeners know, I am a CEO and co-founder of a health tech venture myself, which is called PocDoc. PocDoc's flagship product, the Healthy Heart Check, is now the number one health check on the high street. And you can get it across any of the major pharmacy groups, and it will give you the equivalent of the NHS health check in just 8 minutes using your phone anywhere. So if you'd like to know more about that, you can head to pocdoc.co, that's P-O-C-D-O-C.co, or you can go to any of the major pharmacy websites or in-store. So Boots, Well, Superdrug, Pharmacy to You, all of the above. Thank you to everyone who's listening live on UK Health Radio. Thank you so much for tuning in. We absolutely love UK Health Radio. We love the live platform. Johan and his team do an incredible job, and every other presenter on the station is worth a listen. There's a huge amount of amazing content out there, and all of the presenters and all of the shows are available on the UK Health Radio podcast channels. So please do check them out. Thank you to everyone who's listening on demand. So Health Tech Hour is on wherever you get your podcast. So Spotify, Apple, etc. We're across all of them. Thank you if you are watching this on YouTube, or whether you're watching the whole show or whether you're watching one of the best bits that we clip out. And then also thank you if you're watching this on my Instagram channel where we clip the best bits out, which is at Steve Roost. So follow, subscribe. Thank you so much for your support. We get downloads from listeners in over 50 countries every single month, which is absolutely mental to me. So thank you so much. It means that we're doing something right. As I always talk about last week's show, the previous show, last week's show was with Lord James Bethel. Lord James Bethel was one of the founders of Ministry of Sound, which is a huge calling card for anyone of kind of, you know, give or take my age. And it is, he's one of now the UK's leading health advocates, advocating for how we can make the UK healthy again. So if you're interested in some really detailed insight into health policy and how we should be changing the view of prevention into a major area of GDP growth, then that is the show for you. On to this week's show. This is another show where we're covering something that we've never covered before. And actually, this topic came up when we spoke to Dr. Natalie Banner a couple of shows ago when we did a genomics special. So Dr. Banner is the leading ethicist in the world at this point, being the chief ethicist for for Genomics England. And she was talking about this area of pharmacogenomics. So pharmacogenomics is effectively, but my guest today will kind of give us more detail, is basically the development of drugs or the assessment of drugs as to how efficacious they will be based on your genetic profile. Or rather, your genetic profile will dictate what drugs will work better for you in any given situation. So my guest today, Dr. Mark Hudson-Peacock, is the founder and CEO of Mantara, which has launched the first commercially available pharmacogenomic tests in the UK. Pharmacogenomics was all over the 10-year plan, as was genomics, and is one of the sort of big hopes, big bets in the therapeutic space. So it's going to be great to get into it. And Mark, in addition to his amazing work at Mantara, is also the CEO and founder of Xroid, which happens to be one of the leaders in the hemorrhoid treatment field. So we've got quite a bit to talk about on today's show. So Mark, welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Thanks, Steve, for having me on the show. It's a privilege to be here, and I hope we can have some fun talking about some of my favorite subjects.
I'm sure we will. So on the let's kick off with this pharmacogenomic stuff. So genomics was mentioned about a bazillion times in the 10-year plan, if you read it, which obviously anyone in the space, I'm guessing, views positively, although it remains a bit unclear about how to translate that goodwill into actual action. But what's your background and how did you become involved in the space?
Well, my background is I trained in medicine. I trained at the University of in Wales, at the University College of Wales of Medicine, and that was in 1987. I qualified, and I started down a pathway of initially wanting to do surgery, but then thought that the lifestyle at that time was pretty intense. Probably enjoyed the medicine that I did in my house jobs and decided to do medicine. And then it's just how life goes. I ended up being a dermatologist, a surgical dermatologist, still am part of the week, and absolutely love it. I mean, it's such a privilege to be a doctor, to help individual patients and get them on a pathway for better life quality, and sometimes in the space of skin cancer, which is one of my areas of interest, saving lives, which is a wonderful thing to be able to do. But along the way, when I became a consultant, I started my own clinic down in Canterbury with my wife. We set up the Canterbury Skin and Laser Clinic, which still exists. We sold that about 8 years ago to an equity company. That's another story. And now we're owned by Bupa. And so essentially, I'm a part-time Bupa employee working in the clinic, which I absolutely love. So, how did I get to pharmacogenomics? Well,
Yeah, how did you get there?
along the way, oh, it's quite a story. But to keep it reasonably brief, otherwise we could be here all afternoon. I became friends with a chap in America through my X-Roid journey. Originally, we were using treatment for hemorrhoids using an American device called Ultroid. So I went out to America about 11, 12 years ago to train how to do it with a friend of mine, Graham, who had come across the treatment when he was on holiday in Thailand. And that's a story in its own right. There was no one doing it in the UK. He approached me. I said, absolutely not. I'm a dermatologist. I don't do that sort of thing. But at the same time, I looked into it for him and it looked so straightforward and ultimately extremely safe for patients. So I got involved. And we went out to America. I learned how to do it. He learned about it as his background was in sales. And we came back and set up the company in the UK to provide that treatment. However, about 3.5 years into that journey, at which point we had 15 clinics and trained colorectal surgeons around the UK doing it, we had to stop doing it overnight because the Americans, bless their cotton socks, fell foul of good manufacturing practices and did not pass their FDA audits and were told to do a worldwide recall, and our life fell apart. So, having got a product, got it up and running, just became profitable, we had to stop overnight. So it was a disaster. However, we made some inquiries of the legal profession in America and in Europe and in the UK, and we found out that they hadn't protected their IP. And we weren't confident that they were going to resolve the paperwork issues because there was nothing wrong with the equipment. So, following that, we basically sent everything back to America. And I sat down with my colleague Patrick, who was on the journey with Graham and myself, and other colleagues, and redesigned the equipment. And we thought, it'll only take about 6 months. We need to raise a bit of money. 6 months tops, we should get a CE mark then. But that didn't quite happen quite as quickly as that. In fact, in the end, we had to raise a fair bit of money and a lot of blood, sweat, and tears. And we eventually got our CE mark granted 2.5 years later, and launched in March 2019. So, where does that take me into pharmacogenomics? Because that's all about piles. And
Which we can come back to because that afflicts a lot of people.
oh, absolutely. I mean, it's one of the commonest conditions known to man, and it's the second most embarrassing condition to talk about after sexually transmitted diseases. But no, I became friends with one of the guys who was brought into the American company to raise funds for them. And ultimately, we found out that the reason they failed is they'd run out of money and were trying to wing it, doing the regulatory work themselves, which I now know is something you cannot do. You need expertise to be able to do that. And but after a year, he got fed up with them. But we become quite good friends, and he was quite interested in the pharmacogenomic space, which was in its relative infancy in America. I mean, they're certainly well ahead of where we are. And had a good friend of his whose mum had had a test using a panel test, and she had been on 15 medications, had this panel test, and ultimately her medications were rationalized to four, which meant that she was on 11 medications she didn't need. And funny enough, she felt a hell of a lot better, and the problems they were trying to address were being addressed appropriately. The problem is that she'd been given several medications to try to sort things out, and then got side effects. So was given a medication to solve a side effect, and ultimately, when it was all rationalized, she went down to four medications, which got me very excited. And they wanted to set up a company to provide such a service in America, which they did, and they are. However, I wanted to bring their product into the UK and to Europe. They needed to get, because it's classified as a medical device, they needed to get a CE mark under the old regulations by a certain date, which we supported them to achieve. They didn't hit that mark, so that wasn't going to happen. And I know from having gone through this process with Xroid, it was going to take several years before they would have a chance of getting through that quagmire. So I looked around Europe to find out if there was anyone else there that had a CE mark, which I was keen to make sure if you were going to work with a product, it had to have a CE mark. And there really wasn't anything at that
And
time.
what were they? What was the medical device bit of it? Because is it a lab test or what is it?
Yes. So it's a lab test. So essentially, it's the product we use. It can be cheek swab, it can be saliva, it can be blood. But with our panel test, the Mantara panel test, it's saliva in its D2C setup. So patients can buy it, they get a receive a pack, they spit into a tube, they send it back to us, and we do the rest. It goes to a lab, and there is software algorithm in the background which takes worldwide genetic data and then looks at the individual's genetics, and then clever bit of algorithm work in the background then collates all that information significant to the patient because of their genetic variants, and basically matches their medication with the DNA that they have personally, rather than using the one size fits all approach, which is what we have traditionally done in medicine.
So how did you get hold of the how does it actually work? Because are you basically saying that you could upload my genetic profile, it will tell me what medications I should be on, or is it very specifically about whether you should be on this medication or that medication?
Well, the way it works is we look at, so we follow the algorithm that was developed for academia. There was a trial done across Europe. It was European funded across seven countries, including the UK and Germany. They used Biologis algorithm for this study, and the study was called the PREPARE study. It was a blinded study where there were two groups. One was prescribed as normal. Look, when using 78 specific drugs that had been selected by the seven pharmacogenetic luminaries across Europe as the key medications where there was sufficient genetic information to really use that information in what we call an actionable way. In other words, what the result said makes sense and you can trust it. And the other group was you have preemptive pharmacogenomic testing, work out what your genetic variants are, and then depending on the report that you get relating to those 78 drugs, you prescribe based on that information. And those two groups were blind. It was a blinded study, it was a randomized study. And when it was eventually published in February 2023 in The Lancet, it showed that if you use preemptive pharmacogenomics, the incidence of significant side effects was reduced by 30%, which is not an insignificant number. And our product is that algorithm that's been commercialized as the Mantara test for the UK initially, and potentially we can move it further afield once we have got significant traction here. That's the plan.
And how, but it applies to any type of medication, or is it like specifically for specific things?
It's for those specific 78 medications.
Those
So,
78. Okay, cool. Because that's what's in the original study.
yes, that's what's in the original study, and that's that, and we've stuck to
It's
that.
still quite a lot, right?
Pardon?
That's a lot of medications.
That's a lot of medication. It's not all in one area. It covers the majority of mental health medications, proton pump
Okay.
inhibitors, etc.
So, and how does it like, how much acceptance is there in the medical community around this sort of concept generally? Like, where are we at the moment, do you think?
I think at the moment we're in a position of no one knows about it, or very few people know about it. It's
Okay.
certainly being talked about more at the moment, but when you speak to most general practitioners, they haven't heard of pharmacogenomics as
Yeah.
a concept even. When you talk to patients, they think you're talking in gobbledygook. They don't quite get it because, of course, if you go to the doctor, they give you something. He wouldn't give you something, or she wouldn't give you something that doesn't work, would they? Well, no, but at the same time, yes. The reality is that 90% of the medications that are prescribed only work in 30 to 50% of patients they're given to. In other words, you're tossing a coin every time you give a medication to a patient as to whether it could work or not. And previously, we haven't had the tool to be able to determine for the patient in front of which way you go. So you're literally tossing the coin.
Why is it? And I this is not, you know, sometimes they say, oh, you should always know the answer to the question before you ask it. We're not that type of show. So most of the time, I have no idea what the answer is to any question I ask, which is, I think, why. But so maybe the secret to our success, I don't know. But I definitely don't know the answer to this question, which is why I'm asking it. Like, how can it be, or what is the actual mechanism that means that on a genetic level, some people react differently to certain medications? Or better or worse, or they're just ineffective, or like what is going on there?
Okay, well, let's just take an example, and it's the example that the National Institute for Health and Care Excellence, or NICE, have published on last year. They issued guidance around a specific drug called clopidogrel. Now, clopidogrel is what we call a prodrug. That means it needs to be converted in the body into its active form for it to actually work.
Okay.
Now, we know from studies that 32% of the UK population do not have the enzyme to convert that particular drug into its active form. So 32% of people that take clopidogrel, it does absolutely nothing. It doesn't work as intended. And that particular drug is important because it's the drug that is favored if somebody presents with a TIA, a transient ischemic attack, or a stroke. And it doesn't work in 32%. Having said that, if you happen to be British South Asian, it's around 57% it doesn't work in. And that's already for a group that are at higher risk of getting coronary artery disease and
How
other.
did it get to, how did it get through clinical trials in the first place? Did it just not it did, how did they adjust for that 32% figure?
Well, I think the reality is pharmaceutical companies, when they are developing drugs in the earlier stages and getting them through the various phases of trials, if a drug doesn't work in at least 30% of the patients that they're trying it on, it's not taken to commercial fruition. But they
Right.
may have spent millions of dollars at that point, only to put them back on the shelf. So that's the reality. So from a commercial point of view, a drug has to work in at least 30% of patients. And it and historically, genetic information of of the individual patients that have been recruited to trials have not been looked at to find out whether that drug suits them or not. I think there are certainly some companies that that have to be very careful in terms of going forward, and I think trials in the future will need to account for pharmacogenomics. And of course, it
Yeah,
might be
because
coming from
it's about the difference between like lab effectively and the real world, which is somehow you've got good enough real world data to get through nice evaluation, congratulations. But then when it hits the streets, it doesn't work in 30% of people straight off the bat.
I mean, that's the reality, or if not more. So I
Right.
think you know
Yeah,
it's
in the case of South Asian population.
yeah. So there we go, and
Wow.
it helps prevent further strokes.
And this drug is available, is this the first line treatment? Basically, this is the default, or what is
Yeah,
this
so
some
it
weird and
is.
wonderful thing? No.
No, it's the default drug. It's a very cheap drug now because it's been around a long time, and
Okay.
it does reduce the risk of people having subsequent TIAs and strokes. It doesn't stop every single one, but it does work. However, it does not work if you happen to have the genetic variant that means there's a slight abnormality in the DNA, which means that for that particular patient with that variant, and as I say, that's 32% of the UK population, so one in three of us, if you have that variant and you're given this drug, it doesn't work. And we
So,
know
like, that sounds like a fairly serious problem, you
yes.
know, without wishing to sort of, I don't know, minimize it. But what has been the reaction to that specific issue? Is it sort of accepted by the medical community? Are they interested? You know, because that sounds like a cut and dry. It's not some kind of weird and wonderful concept of, you know, epigenetic expression and la la la. It's like they don't have the gene that means you don't have the enzyme to make the thing to metabolize the drug, basically,
Correct.
right? So what has that, but how millions of doses of this drug are given out every year, I suspect? I've no idea. Probably quite a few.
Oh, I think a hell of a lot. Yes. I mean, there are about 100,000 TIAs and strokes in the UK every year. And historically, the treatment of choice has been clopidogrel, which stops platelets being as sticky as they are normally, which
Right,
helps
so it
reduce the
reduces the
risk of
chance of
further
a
clotting.
clot. So, but like, was this some big scandal in that space, or it was sort of no one's worried, or like, what's the kind of vibe on this?
Well, I think, well, that's a really good question. I mean, it scares the life out of me. If I had a relative of mine given this drug to help prevent a stroke, I would go and get them a test if they weren't going to buy it themselves. That's my personal view, because I want to know that they were on a drug that actually stood a chance of helping them. And if it didn't, then there are alternatives that can be given which will reduce their risks of having a subsequent event. And having a TIA or a stroke, particularly a
This is
stroke,
what I mean. Like
time.
we've done shows. One of the shows I remember vividly, we did a show on, and I know Johan, this was one of your favorites, was around cancer with Dr. Jane McClelland, or Jane McClelland. I'm not sure she's a doctor, and I don't want to reopen it, but her point was she was using some very heavily non-approved methods in treating stage four cancer, and she claimed there's evidence, whatever, but it was high. What she was doing was highly disputed. Now, she was doing chemo and radiotherapy, but also kicking in a bunch of this quite highly disputed stuff, which, you know, some people are really pro it and some people are really not. But the point I'm trying to make here is that some of that stuff is genuinely up for really serious academic debate. This sounds like it is absolutely not up for academic debate.
Well,
There's
totally not.
32% of people. There's 32% of people that the drug cannot work for. This is not some weird, wonderful argument about I read an article and this it said this. This is like it was fairly cut and dry. Is that fair?
Absolutely. Absolutely fair. And the reality is, NICE, National Institute for Health and Care Excellence, have issued guidance stating that anyone coming into the NHS who's had a TIA or a stroke should be given a preemptive pharmacogenomic test to work out whether clopidogrel works for them or doesn't. And if it doesn't, they go on the alternative, which is usually
So
ticagrelor.
on that note, because that sounds eminently sensible, but I suspect when you scratch beneath the surface, there's more to that we will get into after this commercial break. We'll be right back with Dr. Mark Hudson-Peacock, the CEO of Mantara, who have launched the first commercially available pharmacogenomic test specifically focused right now on clopidogrel, which is used to prevent future TIAs and strokes. How did I do with that? I didn't even look at my notes on that one. Look at that. Just straight out. Right, we'll be back in 2 minutes.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach, here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment. We explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism, and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving. It's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
When you vacation with Norwegian Cruise Line, every day is a new day. Get a taste for Barcelona, then savor incredible dining options back on board one day. Connect to ancient history in Athens and then disconnect completely in our spa another day. Wherever the sea breeze takes you, come aboard and experience a different tomorrow with NCL. Visit ncl.com, call your travel agent, or call 0333-336-1472. Norwegian Cruise Line, Ships Registry, the Bahamas and USA.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Hello and welcome back to the second part of this week's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roost, and my guest today, Dr. Mark Hudson-Peacock. So Mark, just before the break, you said that NICE had issued guidance that anyone coming into hospital with a TIA or stroke should be given a pharmacogenomic test. Is that correct? That's what you said?
That's what the guidance states.
That's what the guidance says. Where in the real world, what is actually happening? Is that happening, or what, you know? Yeah.
No, not yet. Well, I say not yet. There are four pilot sites that are being run in England, using a point of care device run by a company called Gene Drive. Okay. So patients come in, the test is done. It's a cheek swab test. You put it into the machine, and within an hour or so, you have an answer to say, yep, the drug works or no, it doesn't. So in theory, it can work instantly and give information. I believe that the pilot sites have been run and the data is being analyzed and is due to be published. But of course, until that time, I think most trusts are just kicking the can down the road. Of course, I'm absolutely livid about that, because the evidence is there. Indeed, in the NICE guidance, it states that it costs on average about £50,000 a year to look after a patient who's had a stroke.
Yeah.
And if we accept that 32% of people are put on a drug that actually isn't going to work for them and they are going to have more strokes, we know from studies that there's a 46% higher risk that they will have a stroke compared to if they've got the gene variant that does convert that drug into its active form and therefore it works. Yeah. And so there are people coming in. Of course, every day of delay in the implementation of this relatively simple test is costing people their lives, either in terms of quality of life from a second event or, worse case, they could die from it.
Where do you stand on using point of care tech versus a lab on this type of issue? I'm not an expert on genetic testing, so I don't, you know, different horses, different courses, but what's your take on it?
I think, looking through the NICE guidance, they have recommended lab testing as the first choice, point-of-care testing as a second choice, and the panel tests like the Mantara one being a sort of a third choice, because it's a lot slower. I think the advantage of getting labs able to do testing or point-of-care tests, they can get information very quickly back so that the physicians can decide whether the drug is the right one for the patient or not. Lab-based panel testing takes longer, and therefore there is a delay between getting the test and it coming back. So ideally, a lab-based test, if it's available, and that's the thing, if it's available. Now, yeah. The reality is, in the UK, we are leading the world in some aspects of genomics, but in pharmacogenomics, we're not. We've got fantastic research organizations, but there is no commercial setup to be able to provide at scale the amount of testing that's required to be able to fulfill the requirements of the NICE guidance. So if it was implemented tomorrow, there are no labs in the UK that can do it. There are no bioinformaticians or insufficient bioinformaticians and geneticists to be able to sense check the data.
Oh, really? Because there's that level of complexity to this that you need a whole kind of, it's not like a yes, no concept. There's a whole infrastructure around it to be able to determine the right answer.
At the lab-based level, yes. Point of care testing with the Gene Drive device, no, you don't need to be an expert, because the work has been done. You put it into the device, an hour or so later it comes out telling you what alleles the patient has and whether those particular alleles relating to that patient's genetic variant, specifically around CYP2C19, which is the bit of the gene, one of the gene that produces the enzyme that metabolizes the clopidogrel in the liver. It tells you what alleles they've got and whether or not the drug is going to work or not. And if not, then the physician can choose an alternative approach to managing that patient in the acute setting.
And how do you think that have you heard anything back channel about how the pilots have gone? Because it's super interesting.
I haven't, no.
Okay.
I'm waiting with bated breath because, and I know GeneDrive will be as well, who
Yeah, I
produce
bet.
the devices. I mean, the fact of the matter is, within the NICE guidance, it says, as long as a test costs less than £1,920, it's going to save money for the NHS. Well, the tests are significantly cheaper than that.
Right.
So every day of delay is it's money being wasted, patients' lives being affected. So it's, for me, I think it's an absolute disgrace that this information hasn't already been considered and implemented in the
I mean,
NHS.
I think it's going to be interesting because obviously I'm guessing, but I might be wrong, but the clinicians on the ground are going to want the answer as quickly as possible. I'm guessing because they're going to want to know whether to put the person on this drug or not put the person on that drug. So the lab one could be tricky, right? Because how that's, yeah, that's a
Well,
hard one.
the infrastructure isn't there. Well, I mean, the government realized this, and we
Right.
know that the NHS plan had a DNA helix painted on the front cover, so we
Oh, they love,
know.
I tell you what, they love writing the word genomics.
It is.
Write that everywhere.
But nothing in the piece describes how it's going to be implemented. But again, government realized that, and they have set up these Centers for Excellence in Regulatory Science and Innovation, so-called CERSI groups. There are seven of them. One of them is in the area of pharmacogenomics, and I've been involved with that. It's a collaboration between industry, academia, the regulators, including MHRA and NICE, the Medical Research Council, etc. So it's a very broad scope, and it's really to work out how do we get pharmacogenomics into the UK and into the NHS as quickly as we can, because I think there's no
Scale
doubt
it scalably and
yes.
sort of efficiently, if you see what I
Yeah.
mean. Because it's
And
like you've got to think about how those samples are going to go backwards and forwards and be analyzed and things
yes.
like that. There's a whole, it's a whole system.
The whole system. And that's really where, there's got there are a number of work groups around, well, looking at clopidogrel specifically, because obviously that's the subject of NICE guidance. How are we going to get this into the UK, into the NHS and working?
Is any other system doing really well on clopidogrel? Like, has anyone else kind of cracked the pharmacogenomic thing pre, you know, is anyone else you're like, oh, those that country's absolutely smashing this thing with clopidogrel?
In Holland.
Okay.
Yes, they have got it implemented within their system so that when patients go into pharmacies, I understand they will get pharmacogenomics as part of the process to make a decision. I
Cool.
know that in Spain they have legislated that anybody is entitled to a pharmacogenomic panel test. They haven't got the infrastructure to deliver that if everyone turned up
So
and asked it.
when I just want to check some terminology. So when you say panel test being different from a lab test, what is
Right.
that difference?
Okay, so the CYP2C19 clopidogrel test is a single a single gene they're looking at for
Okay.
a single drug.
Right.
So that's that. That can be a lab-based test. It can be a point of care test by the bedside, essentially. What a panel test is looking across a number of different genes. So the Mantara panel test looks at 12 different genes that are
Okay.
important in drug metabolism, looking across 78 drugs. So that's a panel test.
Oh, so
They're looking at a panel
that's
of,
like your
yeah.
whole thing against that prepare study. So that's like,
Correct.
got it. So your sort of angle is like, look, you can do the single point of care or single
Ablation.
gene
Yeah.
piece for
Yes.
clopidogrel.
Yeah.
That's one way to go.
Correct.
And or you can also then just analyze everything against the 78 drug database and then you know everything. So
So,
instead of like, because that person might need, they might do the clopidogrel test, but that doesn't mean we've solved any of the other pharmacogenetic issues.
correct. Correct.
Right.
So
Got it.
in an acute setting, being able to know is this drug going to work or not is actually quite useful.
Yeah.
But that doesn't, I mean, the NICE guidance doesn't take into account the people who are on clopidogrel already. So they fall outside of the NICE guidance. So if any patients on clopidogrel wanted to get it,
How long can you be on Pepe? How long are you generally can one be on clopidogrel for?
you can be on it for a number of weeks or you can be on it for years.
Wow.
Yeah. I was out dog walking not long before this show and bumped into a friend of mine who had a cardiac stenting 4 years ago. He's still on clopidogrel. I was talking about it and he said, "Do
Wow.
you mean this drug might not actually work for me?" I said, "Well, there's about a one in three chance it doesn't." No. He said, "Oh." I said, well, that's the power of pharmacogenomics, because we were chatting about
Wow.
how it's going to come on the show, and I was just
Yeah.
talking about it. And he said, that's mad. He said, so I could have been taking a drug for 4 years without realizing it, if it's doing anything for me or not. I
Is
said, on
there
the
any
positive
like,
side, you haven't had another heart attack. I said, on the negative side, that may be luck rather than judgment.
Yeah, it could be. I mean, look, let's just be happy, but generally it
Yes.
might not be, you know. But what, wow. I mean, is there any kind of, why do you think that they're not, I guess cost and feasibility is going to be the big ones, but are they concerned about sort of liability if they have to sort of kind of say, oh, we're sorry, you've been on this thing and it wasn't working and we knew that kind of thing?
Well, at the moment, we don't know that. It's only if you do a test,
That's what I
then you
mean.
know. And
Yes.
then it's about, okay, you can take that information and have a discussion with the doctors looking after you to say, okay, I've had this test done and it says that clopidogrel doesn't work for me. It's suggesting I should go on an alternative drug. So I think a GP confronted that information is likely to want to liaise with the cardiologist or the stroke
Yeah.
physician. Say, look, this patient's come along. What do you want me to do? Or do you want to see the
Well,
patient to look
I
up an
think that
alternative?
there's definitely going to be an issue about education
Yes.
at primary care,
Yeah. I
because
mean, an education, not just of primary care, but of secondary care, of
yeah.
pharmacists, of regulators. So everybody involved in this space is going to need education around pharmacogenomics,
The
what it
thing
is,
is
what it
interesting because
means, and how we use it.
when my friend Natalie Banner came on, one of the other issues that she highlighted, which is where she kind of plugs in from an ethics perspective, is where does this data live right now? Because there isn't a place for your pharmacogenetic profile to live in the system. It
No.
doesn't there that you there isn't a place in your medical record
No.
for it.
I think at the moment, our test is very much a flat test. It's a PDF.
Yeah.
Patients can have it on their phone, on a piece of paper, in their handbag, wherever they want it. It could also be uploaded into their NHS app, in theory, but it's not part of an integrated electronic patient record system yet, but that is an
But you
aspiration.
know, if you we can chat about this separately, but there's a company called Patients Know Best that has an integration with the NHS app. So you could do that right now. You could get it
Yeah,
into the
and I
app.
think, I mean, a lot of people say it's really important it's part of the electronic patient record, and I absolutely agree with that. So, taking it to the umpteenth, you're born, you have a pharmacogenomic test, and that information is uploaded into electronic patient record. So at some point in your future life, when you need medication, the smorgasbord of choice will be assessed by the genetic variants you've got, and it may be reduced. If you're
I mean, wouldn't that be something,
Yes,
you know,
and
to
that's
kind of.
ultimately where it'll go. I mean, that is what will happen at some point in the future, because why wouldn't it happen that way? I think at the moment it's about, well, no one knows about it. How do we get it out there? And part of the CERSI group plan is around education, educating professionals and educating the regulators and educating patients, and then working out how we use it. Of course, there are a lot of companies out around the world doing pharmacogenomics, but they're all using different alleles, different guidance, different
Really
information. So regulation needs to be really tight. And
interesting.
that's why I've very much been passionate about sticking to an evidence-based algorithm, which is specifically the PREPARE study,
Oh,
the one.
that's interesting. I hadn't realized that there's elements of sort of interpretation in how you
Oh, yes.
test and analyze these things.
Yes, there's a lot of
Wow.
that.
Is
So,
there?
I mean, there's a lot of information out there, which is very interesting, but we don't know what it means yet. The actionable information, which is where there's pretty much cut and dry evidence that the information you're getting, you can trust, and it is relevant for the patient. However, we just need to be aware that not every product is the same. And if you do whole genome sequencing and get pharmacogenomic advice, it's nowhere near as good as qPCR, real-time PCR analysis, which is much more accurate when it comes to looking at pharmacogenomics. But of course, on the surface of it, no one would recognize that or realize that.
No, I would. I mean,
So,
I mean, I'm not exactly like, you know, some numpty from the corner, and I wouldn't understand the difference between a qPCR genetic pharmacogenetic test and a whole genome pharmacogenetic. I mean, that wouldn't be immediately obvious to me at all.
no, but people in the pharmacogenomic space would recognize that. And I think,
Yeah.
I mean, yes, technology is, improving dramatically, and costs are coming down significantly when you consider what the first genome sequencing costs,
Yeah.
a huge amount of money, and now you can get it done very much more cheaply. But just because you know all the genes that are there, you don't necessarily know what the answers are from a pharmacogenomic perspective. So having studies done to test your product in the market in a blinded fashion is very powerful in terms of giving credibility to the product, which is why Mantara is that product. So
And
we're
and
looking forward to working with that.
where does the kind of hidden hand in all of this, big pharma, where do big pharma stand on pharmacogenomics? Pro, anti, neutral, waiting to see what happens? Like what's going on with those guys?
I haven't spoken to many big pharma people, but I do know that that there are some drugs which don't have genetic implications. So some pharma companies are going down that route. Happy days. Others are looking at some of the medications. And of course, if you think about it, the majority of medications that have been tested up to that point, when they then found out actually it doesn't work in 30%, it's gone back on a shelf. Here's a massive opportunity for pharma. They can blow the dust off some of these amazing drugs that are there. It might only work in 5% or 10% of the
But
population, but
if you find that five to
it's
10%, away we go.
100%. So I
That's
think going
great.
forward, it's about using pharmacogenomics as another tool to craft your patient groups when you're looking at the drugs that you're
I tell you
trying to
what,
find out they work.
if those guys get into it, then I think that this thing's gonna they're gonna blow the doors off this thing. I mean, because
100%.
their ability to influence markets, rightly or wrongly, is quite high.
Yes.
So we're gonna go for our
I'm actually,
final.
we've been approached by one pharma company to for this very question. We have a drug that, but we need to know what the patient's pharmacogenomic profile is around this particular gene variant. Can you do it? Yes, we can. So we've had a conversation with one pharma company already who are looking at pharmacogenomics to help determine which patients get their drug and which ones
Also,
don't.
like I
So,
bet for those guys, it's going to be like a land grab race. Like whoever has the best ability to analyze pharmacogenomics can churn out the best, most efficient drugs, which means they make more money. Like
absolutely. It's a massive
that's
opportunity.
makes
Massive.
sense to them. Right. We're going to go for our final commercial break with my guest today, Dr. Mark Hudson-Peacock. We will be right back.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Apples and pears, beef and skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, aunt and deck, fish and chips, mum and dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com.
Strawberries and cream.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
The station that makes you feel good.
Hello and welcome back to the final part of today's show with Dr. Mark Hudson-Peacock. And we've, to be honest with you, pharmacogenomics has really dominated the show because it's so fascinating. What we can do, I think, is just try and tie this pharmacogenomics piece off, because I do want to leave a little bit of time to talk about hemorrhoids, which is your other area of specialty. Because
Yes.
again, on this show, we talk about anything. We don't care about, things being awkward or whatever. We talk about it. So, what's your hope for the next 1 to 3 years in the pharmacogenomics space, Mark?
Well, I think if the CERSI-PGx group is able to be supported in terms of what its aspirations are, and that's around education, regulation, health economics, and implementation, most importantly, I'd like to hope that stroke management will improve once the clopidogrel pharmacogenomic test is implemented in the NHS, and I'm sure that's going to happen over the next year or so. And then to start to embrace the other areas of medicine, and particularly mental health, which is very, very poorly managed in the UK. Waiting lists are, you know, through the roof. ADHD, a lot of people are not being added to waiting lists to be seen with ADHD, such as the demand. So when you understand that pharmacogenomics, when you look at mental health drugs, most of them only work in about half the cases, if not more. So if you know what drugs the patient can go on that suit them genetically, you can immediately start to make the whole mental health management process so much more efficient. So many patients will go on a drug, they will be gradually titrated up, they either get side effects, it's not working, they titrate down, then they start another one, and off we go again. And it's trial and error, toss a coin. Yep. What pharmacogenomics does, it gives you a two-headed coin. You're going to get heads every time. Now, that's not going to set, that doesn't mean the drug is going to work. It means it suits the patient genetically, but you're starting off with a point that it's going to work genetically, as opposed to it's not going to work genetically. Mm-hmm. So there's no point starting it.
And so I understand with clopidogrel, the issue is that the way that the drug is manufactured, it needs to be metabolized. Is that right? Broken down? Yeah. Is that right? Into its active form, and the only way to do that is with a particular enzyme. So if you don't have the enzyme, then you're tough out of luck, so to speak. Is it the same situation with some of the neurological drugs, or is it a different sort of mechanism?
Different mechanisms. So some of the genes will activate medications, some of them will improve their carriage, some of them will be involved in the breakdown of drugs.
Oh, wow.
So clopidogrel is what we call a prodrug, so it's not active. A lot of drugs are like that. So codeine as a painkiller is also a prodrug. So if you happen to have a CYP2D6 and you're a poor metabolizer of that particular gene, it won't work. You can have as much codeine as you like, it ain't going to give you any pain relief. And the same can be true for tramadol and oxycodone. So if you know what your genes are, you can start to manage pain more effectively. Some drugs and the same gene, CYP2C19, is involved with proton pump inhibitors like omeprazole and ansoprazole for helping heartburn and reducing the risk of GI bleeds. But if you happen to be an ultra-rapid metabolizer of that particular gene, for clopidogrel, perfect, it's going to work for you. But if you have a proton pump inhibitor, you probably need threefold higher dose for it to work, because the drug just gets broken down so quickly because you're an ultra rapid metabolizer of that particular drug.
It's really about precision as well, isn't it? It's not just will it work, won't it work. It's a lot about there's a lot going on here.
So it may be that you reduce the dose or you may increase the dose. So I've had my Mantara test done, of course I have. I haven't got many drugs that don't suit me, but one of them is warfarin. I'm not on warfarin, but if I needed warfarin, a blood thinner, I would need to start off on half the normal dose, because my risk of having a bleed complication would be extremely high. And this is a very common variant that people have. I happen to have that one. My wife, on the other hand, she's got a whole host of variants which have impact probably 20 or 30 drugs out of the 78 that are on the list. And some of those would be, you need a higher dose, some you need a lower dose, and some don't take that at all because it just doesn't suit you. So it's a great thing for the here and now. If you're on medication, to try and rationalize what you're on, it's good for the here and now. If you're not on any medication, but at some point in the future, you almost certainly are going to need something, and something on this list will potentially be there, from painkillers, antidepressants, to a proton pump, whatever it is. And it can be part of a rationalizing. So somebody who's on numerous medications, particularly the over 70s, it might be on 10, 15, 20 medications, you can use it to rationalize it, which is how I got involved in this in the first place.
I'm always really honest on the show. I haven't looked into the science of this, but on the assumption that, I mean, it's for international studies, and NICE has issued its guidance, and it isn't really, you don't need me to go and kick the tires on it. There's no way that this doesn't get adopted in some way, shape, or form. I don't exactly know how, but the amount of information that's available here to improve the precision around treatment sounds like it's so great that it's more about the how.
Yes.
And because again, there's an element of it just being a fire hose, and it's too much for the system and individuals in the system to triage down into an actual decision matrix. Because it's like, oh my God, maybe it's a little bit less of that and a bit more of that. And because they've got to have all of their own prescribing rules and regs around it. They can't just be making stuff up either. So, but there's no way that this doesn't happen.
No. I mean, it's what you might call a no-brainer. When you know the fundamentals of it, it's like, why don't we do it? It's because we need to work out how to do it, and that's part of the
Well,
remit of the
it's
Certi
a
Group.
completely different approach to prescribing,
Yes,
basically.
fundamentally different. I mean, when we went to medical school, you learned about disease, and these are the drugs that you treat those diseases with in those situations. What you're not told is actually the drugs only work in about half the people. That's not told yet because we didn't have the information to clarify that. Now we do. So pharmacogenomics needs to be on the medical school curriculum. It needs to be in the pharmacy school curriculums when learning about medications. And then it's about educating the people that are already qualified, that have always done it a certain way. And that's not to say they're bad doctors, they're all probably very good doctors, but here's a tool that can make them be even more effective for the individual in front of them, rather than treating everyone as though they're the same size shape.
Well, and like you said, there needs to be some standardization rule setting around the analysis or the analytical approach, the interpretation of the raw data, etc., so that everyone's on the same hymn sheet.
Yeah, exactly that. And that's why it's a lot of fun. It's very exciting. And already changing people's lives for the
It's
better,
amazing.
those that have
And
had to.
so what has it been like for you moving from pure play medicine into what has now been a number of different entrepreneurial ventures, the skin clinic, the Xroid, and now Mantara?
It's been hard work. It's been exciting. It's been full of ups and downs, twists and turns, and you just adapt to it. I mean, I know not everyone is of that ilk. It takes a certain person and a mindset to want to do something like this, but I've loved it. I mean, the dermatology has given me the comfort financially, and allowed me to pursue some of these areas that have come along, and I've just embraced them and try to work it all out. And any founder CEO, and you will be testament to this, I'm sure. It's not smooth. It's up and down and curveballs. And then Brexit comes along. And then you get a bloody pandemic that kicks you in the face. And you think, for goodness sake, why can't it be just so much? It's not. And then you've got the intransigence of the NHS, the challenges to get in through that brick wall. And then you get through a brick wall and find out actually there's another one on the other side that's even thicker. We need to work out how some of these amazing technologies that are often being driven by smaller companies like ourselves, who get some amazing products, but trying to get it into the NHS is a challenge. But I know they recognize that. But recognizing it and actually making a difference to get some of these technologies into the NHS is too slow. It's too slow, and so many companies run out of money and they fold, and that is a tragedy because there are some fantastic products out there that don't make it. I'm very lucky. I've had some good backers behind me, and certainly in Xroid, we've had a whole load of we've had a, EIS funds that we've had, and we've now got to the point where we're a profitable company, and we're now in, I think, 17 different countries in the world apart from the UK, and growing very rapidly. So it's an exciting time in hemorrhoids as well. And we have, I mean, Xroid is the safest treatment by a country mile over anything else that's out there. And it's technology that's actually been around for over 150 years. It hasn't been commercialized
How does it
successfully
work?
enough. So it's low dose direct current. So you have a salt sponge on your hip, which is the grounding plate, if you like, and then you have a two-prong probe that sits on the base of the hemorrhoid, which you access via a proctoscope, and you start the current, and it just gradually increases the current up to a maximum of around 60 milliamps, so nothing very much, but enough over time just to shrink the hemorrhoid down. And it's a very satisfying treatment to do. I mean, I've probably carried out about 2,000 treatments, and I train lots of doctors and inspire them in the art of Xroid, which is fantastically satisfying. And I've traveled around different parts of the world, inspiring key opinion leaders to want to take this up, as compared to things like cutting and stitching and banding and the other treatments that have been around for so long. It's safer than anything else, and that's the important thing for me is, as a patient, I want a safe treatment and I want an effective treatment. And if I don't have to take time off, all the better. So that's what Xroid is. You can walk in, have it done, walk out. You can treat all four grades of hemorrhoid. No cutting, no stitching, no burning, no theatre. You can do it in the patient's front room. Literally, it's that safe.
Make sure you draw the curtains properly. just in case
you have, in case the neighbours are watching. Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But, you know, actually, I have treated one patient in his front room, and it was quite a tragic story, really. He was involved in a car accident, was paralysed from the neck down, but had hemorrhoids, and they weren't normal sensation; they were altered sensation, and he couldn't get out in his wheelchair, which was a real nightmare for him. So I did a risk assessment, and then I went with my nurse around his house with his carer there, and I treated his hemorrhoids while he was watching the cricket on the telly.
That's great.
He had one treatment, and his life was transformed.
That's great.
And it's the individual patient stories that get me every time.
I think what's clear and what one, you know, the world is changed by people with passion and for whatever those things are involved in. And you clearly have that in spades for all of the different ventures. So, you know, it's great. This is why I love doing the show, is speaking to people and hearing their stories, and you're creating a platform to share those stories with the world. So what I always ask is at the end of every show, if what kind of mottos or phrases have you relied on during your sort of career and these various ventures to get through those tough times, those difficult times, that you might want to share with people if they're going through something tough?
Always know that something better is around the corner. You just don't know what it is yet, where it's coming from, or who that help might be from. But always asking questions, always sharing burdens with somebody else, I think is really important. Taking things on your own shoulders and internalizing it is not healthy, both for your physical as much as your mental health. So I think a problem shared is a problem halved, I always say, and I've never shied away from that. So I think being honest with yourself and involving people that may not have the passion that you have, but have the listening ear so that you can share anything and just sound out issues, get different people's perspectives, and using that insight, use those to create new goals and new approaches to solving a problem.
I think that's a brilliant way to end the show. So Mark, if anyone wants to find out about Mantara and the panel test or Xroid, like where should we direct people? Where should they go?
I guess the website, probably a good place as any. So our website for Mantara is mantara.co, mantara.co. And the Xroid website is Xroid, Xroid.com.
Wow. Thank you very much, Mark, for coming on the show. Thank you to everyone listening. And we will be back again with another show next week. Thank you.
Tastes like strawberries on a summer evening. And it sounds just like a song. I want more berries and that summer feeling. It's so wonderful and warm. Breathe me in, breathe me out. I don't know if I could ever go without. I'm just thinking out loud. Sugar high.